Good morning, starshine. The earth says hello. You twinkle above us. We twinkle below.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Winter is the season.
Good
for
choice of songs.
Starshine from Oliver. Longer nights coupled with lower temperatures make all the difference in the winter. Few among us know the night sky in the winter better than Tom Burns, who actually goes out and...
Yes, and I have the frostbite to prove it, by yeah. God.
He's director of Ohio Wesleyan University's Perkins Observatory. Tom, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
I wanted to start with
happy
some...
Happy Solstice.
Happy Solstice, right.
Happy Saturnalia. That's what we're celebrating right now.
Is that what we're on?
That's what the new year really is.
I wanted to start with some recent news. I want to talk about the solstice. I want to talk about all kinds of stuff, but I wanted to start with this. It caused a stir in the world of astronomy. An odd-shaped interstellar asteroid zipped through our solar system. It's called Oumuamua.
Oumuamua.
Who comes up with the names? And
well, you know, what they have to do with solar system objects is name them after gods. And we've run out of Greco-Roman gods. So it's like a rule. It's a convention. How about that? And so now they're using Hawaiian gods and just all kinds of gods from various cultures, which makes good sense to me, although some of them are deeply unpronounceable.
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua. Oumuamua. So what is it? Why did this cause a stir?
It is a giant monolith from deep space. See, it actually came from another stellar system. Nobody knows what stellar system
it was. How do we know that?
Well, because it's in a hyperbolic orbit, that is... Or a parabolic orbit. Okay. I can't remember which. But the point is, it's not in an orbit that's shaped to go around the sun.
Okay.
So it's coming in toward the sun, dragged by the gravity of the sun. And it had to have come from outside. And it'll whip around the sun and then go off in a direction that will lead it out of our solar system.
Why doesn't it become trapped in an orbit around the sun if it's pulled by the gravity of the sun in the first place? Why doesn't it stay within the gravity of the
sun?
Well,
it gets an assist from the gravity of the sun.
Okay.
And therefore, it is going too fast to be captured into orbit. Some people call this the box. If you're in the box and you're going slowly enough, you're going to be captured into orbit. If you're in the box and you're going too slowly, you're going to get sucked right into the sun. If you're going in the box and you're going fast enough, you're going to zip back out into space. So it's velocity, really, that counts.
And when we say interstellar, do we mean it's a different solar system?
That's a different stellar system, yes.
Okay.
There's only one solar system. It has Sol, our sun, at the center. So, in other words, I'm just mincing words with you, but
okay.
The answer is yes.
Okay.
It came from, apparently, one of those fields of debris that seem to happen in stellar systems. We know that because it happened in ours, the asteroid belt. But so it was dislodged probably because it came too close to the gravity of another object and went zipping out of that stellar system long, long ago. Actually, apparently passed through another stellar system on the way here. So it may have been on this path for hundreds of millions, even billions of years.
What is odd shaped about it?
Well, it's like a sliver. It looks toothpick shaped in the images, but it's actually more extended than that. It looks more like, you know, a kind of thin rectangle, a monolith that came from outer space.
And usually things are more circular,
Well, the objects in our solar system are in orbit, that is, in elliptical orbits that's close to a circle.
Yeah.
That are in orbit around our sun. And that's how they maintain their stability. They're in orbit.
Right.
And so that you know that something is from some other stellar system because it came from way out there.
My guest is Tom Burns. Who else? Who else can talk about an odd-shaped interstellar asteroid that zipped through our solar system?
Hey, cool stuff, yeah. Though, you know. And you don't get many of those. Think about the odds, since the stars are so very far apart,
yeah,
of getting such an object to pass through your solar system. So, you know, astronomers were all agog, and they're going, oh, my gosh, we have to get as much data as we possibly can.
I was going to say, is this something they'll study for?
Well, they'll gather the data, and then they'll study it for a long, long time.
Did they get a lot of pictures?
Well, they got some pictures, but, you know, the thing about that is that images don't provide as much information as getting the data in other bands of the spectrum of energy, of light.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, for example, you take a picture. What's that in? It's in the visual energy. That is the part you can see.
Okay.
That would be the spectrum that you might get when you hold up a prism or wear a pair of rainbow glasses. But there's lots and lots of energy on either side of that visual. On the low end, you've got radio energy and things like that, infrared energy. On the high end, you have X-rays and gamma rays and things like that. So you gather as much data from all of those wavelengths of light, of energy, that you possibly can.
Is this where the phrase "more than meets the eye" came from?
That's part of it.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
I'm sure.
And then there was a large radio telescope pointed at the asteroid.
Oh, yes.
What's the difference between a radio telescope? Is that what they're looking for, all those other rays?
Yeah. What's the difference between a radio telescope and, say, the kind of telescope you'd go to the Z-Mark to buy?
Exactly.
Well, the answer is, of course, that the telescope you go to the Z-Mark to buy is a visual telescope. It looks at the energy in the visual range, which, of course, I mean, what would you do with a radio telescope? Listen to the stars.
Okay.
But a radio telescope looks at the longer wavelengths of energy that are below the red end of the spectrum. Here, I'm holding up my suspenders to the microphone so people can see it better. But if you look at below the red end of the spectrum, you have the infrared, then the radio band. These are very long waved energies.
And you can actually hear something.
Well, what you're actually doing is gathering the data.
Okay.
If you modulated it like we're doing now, then you would hear it. But what it ends up being is a bunch of numbers.
Gotcha.
And those numbers represent information about the object that you couldn't get in the visual, from the visual part of the spectrum.
Might we turn our thoughts now to the lovely, beautiful column you wrote about the Christmas star?
Gosh.
It really was.
Gosh,
it was
thanks.
Delightful. It was. Well, you're a great writer.
He teaches writing, folks. For the Christmas star, of course.
Which was that it was actually
made up.
Yeah. it never really happened.
There's a good argument to say that it was made up because it fulfills biblical prophecy, Ezekiel, I think. And Matthew in particular, that writer of the Bible, is appealing to the kind of Roman cosmopolitan audience that believed in astrology, that believed that the presence of the planets in certain constellations boded, was important in some way. And, of course, that leads to the argument by Johannes Kepler and others some 1,500 years later, 1,600 years later, that it was a planetary conjunction. Because two planets, Jupiter in 6 or 7 BC, two planets were close together, Jupiter and Venus, in the constellation Pisces, the sign of the fish. If you've ever wondered, well, there is an obvious fish connection in the New Testament, but that's another one that's a possibility as well.
But these things, I mean, they occurred at the time of what we think of as Christmas now or at other times.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Planetary conjunctions, which is what we're talking about here, the close alignment of two planets, occur all the time. There's one happening right now. As a matter of fact, in the morning sky, Jupiter and Mars, gorgeous, by the way.
But this would have been spectacular.
The two brightest planets? Yeah, I think the last time we had one was 3 or 4 years ago of Jupiter and more than that. Maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we had a nice conjunction of Jupiter and Venus.
But at the time of when Jesus was born, there wouldn't be any light. Just the sky would be so much more stupendous than it is even today for most of us.
Well, yeah, except that what we're talking about are the two brightest planets. So they're going to be just as spectacular today, maybe even more spectacular, because there are no, you know, you go out into the middle of the suburbs or whatever, and you can still see those two planets and you can't see anything else.
Right. Right. And also, we have all kinds of other pollutants, and it's not just light pollution, but all kinds of things.
Oh, they were going to look great in 6 or 4 BC. That's when another one happened, or 7 BC. Clearly, though, if you believe that, we're celebrating, we got the wrong year going. Because if you count this from the birth of Yeshua, Bar Yosef, then that wasn't 1 AD. That was 7 BC, the way we count it. So,
my guest is Tom Burns. He's director of the Ohio Wesleyan University's Perkins Observatory. We're talking about the night sky, the winter night sky. It's our favorite time of the year to talk about the night sky because it's so spectacular. And
well, there's so many bright stars in the winter sky, and they're all kind of clumped together over there in the south when it gets good and dark about 10 p.m. or so.
And cold.
Cold. The price you pay.
Oh, man.
I have a friend, an old friend, who once went out on a cold winter night. It was about zero. And saw the Horsehead Nebula, kind of the holy grail of telescopic astronomy, the Horsehead Nebula for the first time. And he got serious frostbite in one hand, his thumb and his forefinger especially. But to the last day that I ever saw him, the subject would come up about seeing the Horsehead for the first time and the frostbite, and he would hold up his hand and bend it slowly and painfully, and he'd say, "And yeah, but it was worth it." The winter sky can be so fabulous that you prepare for the cold. You put on your thick-soled boots and your layers and your gloves inside of your mittens. Do I have my winter mittens with me?
Yeah. Oh, we've got a winter hat.
Wait a minute. Let me get it. I want to show you.
You've got
a mitten.
Those
right?
are some serious down mittens.
But
there.
The point is, you got to get your hand out.
Yeah.
So
they've got that hatch.
Oh. And then you wear a pair of silk gloves underneath the mitten, so that you can.
Those are serious.
You're handling eyepieces and stuff, you don't freeze. And you wear a hat. Many hats. Several hats.
Again, my guest is Tom Burns, director of the Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory. We'll continue our conversation. We'd love to hear from you if you have a question or comment about the night sky in winter. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about stars, planets, moons, and other celestial objects in the night sky. Still with us is director of Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory, Tom Burns. Tom, thanks again for joining us.
Hey, whoever's doing the music today has good taste.
Nice job, Michael DeBonis. Let's talk a little bit. I think you alluded to it earlier, the issue of time and the calendar and its astronomical connection. Where did the calendars come from and what is the connection with astronomy?
Well, it's a fundamental connection with astronomy because the month is, of course, the moon's month.
Right.
And the year is how long it takes Earth to make one orbit around the sun. This, of course, creates real problems if you're trying to do a calendar, because a year is 365 and about a quarter days, although not even that exactly.
So every few years we have the leap year thing, right?
Right. But that doesn't take care of it completely because it's not exactly 3 1/4. It's something like 365.2252 or something like that. This doesn't seem like a big deal, right?
I'm laughing, but no, I'm sure it is, or you wouldn't have brought it up.
Give it a 1600 years, and those,
they start
10
to add up.
15 minutes a day add up, yeah.
Yeah. So we tend, January 1st, who decided then?
Once again, January's Janus. It was a bunch of astro nerds under the direction of Julius Caesar.
Right, so we got Roman gods.
Later
and all
on,
that kind
under
of junk.
Pope Gregory the 13th, I think. And they just, there's a certain logic to that because it was actually the year began around the winter solstice, but you lost some days. Because of the problem with the leap year, because they were only doing leap years every 4 years, and you've got to make some adjustments over time in that, or you're going to lose some days.
Why don't we start the year on the summer solstice?
Well, I agree with you 1,000%.
Okay.
I would start it actually at the vernal, the spring equinox.
Okay.
When the world comes together, life comes back.
Right.
But if you think about it, there's a certain logic in starting it at the winter solstice as well, because on the winter solstice, you've got your darkest time, the longest nighttime. And on that date of the winter solstice, the sun begins to come back, the days begin to increase. So if you're looking purely astronomically rather than the effect that it has on the seasons and the natural world, then around the winter solstice is a really good time to start the year. Personally, I'd start it in the spring too. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong.
To the point that we're talking about, Steve in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi. This is it's fun to think about these things. The year and the months are kind of not connected. Well, they're kind of random. It's just a coincidence that months come out to be almost 12. Right? And then you have to adjust for that. That's what you're just
right.
talking about.
Well, it's not random at all. It was designed into the system because it was the easiest way to divide up 365.
Yeah, okay.
And originally, though, I mean, there was a year after the Julian calendar, the Julius Caesar calendar was instituted to make up time. They had 15 months because they had to kind of add days up to 535 days to make up for the problems with the old lunar calendar. Originally, the calendar was purely lunar. It didn't measure years at all.
Huh, interesting. Steve?
Well, what I meant to say was that there's our moon happens to be you know, approximately a month, but it's not like exactly particularly on purpose in sync with our sun. But my real question was to ask if there's any sort of astronomical connection to weeks, the 7-day division. Huh. Is that, you know, that was my real question.
Okay.
It's a good way of dividing up a month. If you assume, you know, 28 days, it's actually not 28 days. That's the problem. The problem is that you want the month to be a certain number of days. But it was all based on the lunar cycles, which go to 29.3, an actual orbit of the Earth, 29.5. An actual orbit of the moon around the Earth is 28.3 or something like that. So you want it to be an even number of days, but you're not going to get it. So the problem is not with the month, it's with trying to create a calendar around it. But the way people, it's not really a coincidence at all. The way people originally measured the passage of time was by looking at the sets of lunar phases. It happened when, you know, the old thing, it happened many moons ago. Mm-hmm. Well, that's how people would have measured when things happened. They happened 20 moons ago or 100 moons ago or something like that. So it's all based on that. The trouble is that doesn't, when you need a calendar, when people have to be at a certain place on a certain day, on a certain time, in other words, when culture becomes more complicated, you have to create a calendar, and there's just no good way of doing that.
Steve, thanks a lot for your call. Carmen in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Carmen.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
My question is for Tom, far as observing space from Earth, how he was describing the ultraviolet spectrum as a source of how we pretty much observe everything in nature. And my question is, by observing other planetary systems in space, would the ultraviolet spectrum change that observation?
Well, the ultraviolet is part of the electromagnetic spectrum, as it's called, which is all the energy at various wavelengths, frequencies. So that any astronomer worth his or her salt is going to get as much data from as many of those wavelengths as possible, and that includes the ultraviolet. So that if you look, say, online at the astronomy picture of the day or something, some of those images are false color images converted to visual images in the ultraviolet or in the infrared, so that they're gathering as much data from as many parts of that spectrum as they can, and that determines what they believe they know about the universe in general and any specific astronomical object.
Thanks, Carmen, for that call. Getting back to the whole calendar thing, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
If the winter solstice is on December 21st, and it's the shortest day of the year, right?
Mm-hmm.
You like to think that it's the longest night of the year.
Yes,
I like
right.
Think it's the shortest day of the year.
Depends on your
point of view. Right.
It's not so important to me because I live in Central Ohio and it's cloudy all the time this time of year.
Although we've had some bright nights, haven't we?
Beautiful nights.
Yeah. Why then is the earliest sunset in mid-December before the solstice and the latest sunrise after the solstice, which is January 3rd this year? It doesn't make sense.
Yes, it does, because if you imagine a perfect solar system, the Earth is not tilted. The Earth goes around the sun at a fixed velocity. Then the earliest sunset and the latest sunrise would happen on the winter solstice. Unfortunately, Earth is tilted with respect to its orbit, 23 degrees.
That's right. That's
and right. It isn't in a circle. Its orbit isn't a circle. It's an ellipse, a kind of stretched out circle. That means Earth gets closer to the sun as it speeds around it, and then as it gets farther away, as it gets closer to the sun, it speeds up. That, you know, it's getting closer to the gravity, it speeds uh-huh. up, Earth does. And as it makes the turn and goes away from the sun, it starts to slow down. The combination of those two effects means, now, this is where, stop thinking about sunrise and sunset and okay. think about local noon, because the two are spaced around that, right? That is, when is the sun highest in the sky? Well, it's not highest in the sky at the same time every day. It's like 10 minutes early before the solstice and 10 minutes later after the solstice by, say, 9 or 10 days either way.
Okay.
So if you shift that local noon that way, that means that the earliest sunset is going to happen before the solstice because local noon happens earlier.
Okay, gotcha.
So the simple answer to your question is everything would be fine if Earth's orbit were a circle. It is not. And if Earth weren't tilted, which it is. So, or think of it another way. You're getting the sun at a slightly different angle at different places in its orbit. And that's going to affect where you see the sun in the sky. And it just so happens before the solstice by, 8 or 9 days, you're seeing it, the local noon and the earliest sunset about 10 minutes earlier. And you're seeing it 8 or 9 days. That is, by the way, the latest sunset this year will happen January 3rd, because everything is happening 10 minutes later. Sorry, it would be easier if I could draw it on the board.
I'm listening, and I think folks out there, if you're listening carefully, you can learn something. So just listen up.
The point is that in a perfect world, everything that you're saying is true, but then we wouldn't have seasons anyway.
Jim in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
He's always one of your most interesting guests. And just a quick aside, I listened to your Eclipse show earlier this year, and I was just so motivated and enthused by Tom. And so I did go out and take a look at the eclipse and how magical it was, and I wanted to thank you both for that and see how his trip went. I know that he was going to follow it. But also, yeah. Also, real quickly, my question is, and I'll let you go. Sure. In the winter sky, recently there have been something on the news about the Air Force releasing photos of UFOs and things like that. Is there anything particular in the winter sky that could easily be mistaken for some sort of unidentified flying or other object? And thank you very much.
Okay, Jim. And just so people know, I do want to talk about the eclipse. Let's talk about it after the next break and get your calls in, get your emails in, and tell us where you watched it from and what you saw. But what about those UFOs in the night sky?
Well, I have to tell you, every time there's a bright planet in the evening or the morning sky, and this tends to be Venus, but in this case, it's going to be Jupiter and Mars since they're close together, we're going to get UFO reports up at Perkins. And this is what I honestly believe. Now, I'm sure there are photographs that show windows and things like that or whatever, but every report I have ever had has been explainable in terms of some astronomical event. I could tell you stories. I've seen them myself, and it took me, 15 or 20 seconds to figure out what was going on. Some astronomical event or some natural event or some object launched by or by somebody that is unusual in some way. I once actually had a guy call me, and he's following this thing with his telescope. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure it out. I mean, it just, he said it was moving slowly. Then eventually it burst into particles and all that. Turned out to be a Mylar weather balloon launched by the National Weather Service. In a kind of desperation, I called them at the local office and asked them if they'd launched a weather balloon and where it was. And lo and behold, that's what it was.
What do you make of the Air Force releasing that information, though, and casting?
Well, I think when it comes to notions like this, if the Air Force spent $22 million to research this, then that ought to be a matter of public record for people to look at. It's my money. It's my money. It's therefore it's my data, and I want my data.
Uh-huh.
But the fact is that you can understand why the Air Force did this, why they studied it, for one thing. There might be visitors from other planets, but there are other possibilities for why they're studying it, like they want to know if their experimental aircraft are being noticed. And, you know, it's just one of those things that you don't want people to see. But and in a lot of cases, especially around so-called Area 51, it's useful information to have when there are UFO reports around Area 51, because that means that people are noticing the flights. So, in other words, there are a lot of reasons. One of them possibly is that the Air Force is convinced that there are aliens among us, visiting us. But there are other possibilities as well.
Jim in Cleveland, thanks a lot for that call. We will turn to the total solar eclipse from this summer. It was a spectacular sight if you were lucky enough to be along the meridian. Is that what you call it?
No, that's all right.
Darn it. I'm
The path of totality.
Path of totality. We'll talk about that. We'll hear what Tom had to say. I'll tell you about my visit. Actually, I'll tell you about the 17 hours it took me to get home from it. Right? So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. Tell us about what you saw when it came to the total solar eclipse this summer. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies. With all the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Night is the best time to observe astronomical wonders, but the daytime is the only time to observe a solar eclipse.
That's right. This August, any other way.
This August, millions gathered across the United States to witness the first total solar eclipse observable from North America in nearly 40 years. So with us is director of Ohio Wesleyan University Perkins Observatory, Tom Burns. If you want to share your story of watching the solar eclipse, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. So, Tom Burns, where did you watch the eclipse this summer?
We were in the Sawtooth National Forest near Stanley, Idaho. We actually made a foray into Stanley to check it out. Population 56, Stanley, Idaho. Population the day of the eclipse, 10,000 people. So we hightailed it back to our campsite and got the most wondrous, magnificent, and life-changing view.
What did you see?
Well,
was the weather good?
The weather was perfect.
Yeah.
Blue skies all the way across.
What
we
was
saw
the temperature?
All of the partial phases. Oh, we were up in the mountains, sort of, so I would guess it was about 70 degrees.
Heaven.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, it was perfect. And, of course, for the 2 minutes and 15 seconds, we had to give up some totality to go west, but we were playing the odds on the weather. For the 2 minutes and 15 seconds, it was one of the most beautiful, awe-inspiring things I have ever seen, second only to the other totality that I went to back in 1991.
Why did, by going west, did you give up some of the totality? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's angles again. That is, you've got on the west coast, you had about 2 minutes and 15 seconds. And then as the shadow of the moon swept across the country, that increased to 2 minutes and 40 seconds in Carbondale, Illinois. And then it tended to decrease slightly as it went down toward the east coast. So it was worth it, though, I have to tell
you. Some of those pictures, now I'm trying to remember if they were actual or if they were just dramatizations of that shadow sweeping across the nation.
No, those are actual.
Yeah, those are actual pictures.
Because
yeah,
we've got satellites in space. They actually took one from the International Space Station that shows that shadow plunked down on Nebraska or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. I was at Kentucky Dam Village State Resort Park in Kentucky. It took us about 17 hours to get home. We didn't speak for the first seven because we were in such a state of shock. But I, having driven for,
hope you had a full tank of gas.
We went so slowly that we didn't even have to stop for 7 hours. Because the traffic was so slow.
You could have gotten out and pushed the car.
Maybe 25, 30 miles an hour.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah. At the top speed until we hit Cincinnati. But we saw it there and we saw the totality. I don't know, can't remember how long it lasted, but it was a first for me. And it was amazing.
Well, stick around for 2024 because there's going to be a totality that passes right through central Ohio,
yeah.
Northwest side of Columbus, where I live, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, and then through Delaware and the center point, the eclipse central of the world.
Yeah.
In April, on April 21st, I think it is, 2024 will be Marion, Ohio, my friends, if it's clear. If
it'll
it isn't,
be a big boon for Marion, I imagine.
Well, if it's clear, but we're talking
that's
April.
A big if.
We're talking April here,
that's
folks.
That's a big if.
My suggestion would be to go south along the eclipse path to Texas or even Mexico.
So it's going in a different direction then?
Coming from the south and moving its way northeast, so that the shadow of the moon passes along whatever part of the earth the arrangement of the sun and the moon and the earth allows to happen. And it's really complicated because of the tilt of the earth and because, these numbers don't divide evenly into themselves and things like that. That's why you're going to get two solar eclipses of some kind every year, but many of them are not visible from places you want to go, and many of them are only partial eclipses, so that having two within a few years of each other in the continental United States is to be predicted from the various cycles involved. But it's still a pretty cool thing, all in all. That one, by the way, will be somewhat longer, just over 4 minutes long.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why? Just because of the whole way, blah, blah, blah.
If the moon is a little bit closer to the sun, remember, these orbits are not circles.
Right.
They're ellipses. If the moon is a little bit closer to the sun, then you get a longer eclipse.
Okay.
In our case, the moon was a little too close to the Earth, so we only got 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Okay.
The maximum possibility, by the way, is 6 minutes and 55 seconds. Oh, no, it's, I'm sorry, around 7 minutes for a maximum eclipse when the moon is, when an eclipse happens when the moon is farthest from the Earth.
How many total solar eclipses have you witnessed?
Two.
Oh, just two.
And I'll tell you, I know people who have seen dozens of them. The so-called eclipse chasers.
They travel all over the world.
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a friend from was a member of the Columbus Astronomical Society who retired so that he could see as many of these as humanly possible. I mean, he literally travels the world seeing eclipses.
And can you relate to that?
I can relate to that.
You would do it if you could do it.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I'd carry along a telescope so that I could do some nighttime observing as well. But I could see doing it. I could see doing it. My wife would have me killed. But, so there are compromises that one needs to make, my friends. Let's face it.
You were at Sawtooth National Forest in Stanley, Idaho. The United States has established its first nature reserve just for stargazing with Idaho's Dark Sky Reserve. Were you anywhere near there?
Yes, we were near there, but that's that whole area. I mean, you know, when the biggest town is Stanley, Idaho, population 56, you know you are in dark skies.
Yeah.
We also spent some time at Glacier National Park afterwards, where with the Wetherall Preserve, which is in Canada, they've made another one of those dark sky preserves.
Oh, here we have Hank in Granville. Let's turn to him. Hi, Hank. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to share my eclipse experience. I'm a pilot of I own a small airplane, and I flew down to Tennessee, and I positioned myself right on the center line of the totality.
That's the place to be.
At 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
And I could see the full circumference of the shadow of the moon.
Oh, yes.
Just out at my horizon was in the sunlight, but beneath me was the shadow of the moon, and it was really moving, and I had the whole thing to myself as well. There was no one else around.
Yeah, you're talking about a shadow that's moving at something like 1,200 miles an hour or something, or some ridiculous number like that. And from up there, you can actually see the thing move, and you can see the edges of it. Did you see the 360-degree sunset effect?
Yeah, I would say I did. The cloud color was the clouds were below me, but they were lighted like purpley gray tires. It was really spectacular. I was hoping to see the shadow approach to get that 1200 mile an hour dark thing rushing up to you effect. The edges were blurrier than I had hoped.
That's the atmosphere at work. You're not going to see a sharp edge the way you see the shadow of the Earth, sharp edge. It's not the shadow of the Earth. The way you see the sharp edge on the moon. You see, it's a kind of a blurry thing if you look at the space images. Yeah, but it's hard to see something coming at 1,200 miles an hour. That's for sure.
Hank, thanks a lot for that call. Emma in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Emma.
Hi there. Yes, and it's two different ones. I didn't know there were two Emmas in Delaware. But anyway, okay. I just wanted to share that we, my husband and I and one son saw the eclipse at Orrin, Wyoming, which is central. And the reason we went there, rather unique, my father homesteaded the land that we watched the eclipse on. And that's true.
That's very good. Cool.
Very good.
It is. It was just really, never underestimate the power of the older. I'm not that old. It was just, anyway.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. We had someone who lived near there, and the temperature drop that no one had mentioned, it was like 87, and in the 2 minutes that the sun was down or covered, it went down to 73, came back up, the sun was out, it came back up.
It was so nice because where we were watching it, it was like 99 degrees.
Oh, my God.
And we enjoyed those brief 2 minutes.
Nothing beats 2 minutes and 30 seconds of shade,
Oh, that is just, and I will just have to share that this was partially my brother, who is now deceased, had planned this. He was an amateur astronomer, but he had a brother-in-law who brought his, he is also in that, fixed up a telescope with a correct film on it so we could look through the telescope. And then he had the reflective one where it went through one and then projected up on a metal, white metal, so we could see it in so many different ways. So,
neat.
Yep. And
the partial phases, yes.
Well, yes, correct. Thank you. Exactly. So that was it. I just had share the uniqueness that very few other people could say that.
Emma, thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, if you're going to go to all that trouble, you should probably bring along every optical instrument you can think of. You need special telescopes, of course, just like you need special glasses to look at the partial phases. But then during the totality, you want your full wide-open telescope or binoculars, because it's only as bright as the full moon for 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Just seeing that shimmering around the total, it was...
Isn't that amazing?
It was totally amazing.
You are looking at is the corona of the sun, the outer atmosphere of the sun.
Yeah.
As that energy erupts from the surface of the sun, is only about 10,000 degrees. In that corona, that energy is moving so fast that it reaches temperatures of hundreds of thousands of degrees. And you can actually watch it move, watch it change.
Right. It was beautiful. Before I let you go, there's a super blue moon eclipse coming up in January.
Blue.
It's a blue moon.
Blue moon. That means there are two moons in the same month. Given the fact that the lunar cycle is 29 and a half days or whatever it is, and that a month can be 30 or 31 days long, you're bound to occasionally get two moons in the same month.
And that's once in a blue moon.
By the way, if you get that in January, guess what's going to happen in February?
What?
No full moon at all.
It steals February's
because
moon.
Because February is shorter than a full set of phases. Now, as far as the lunar eclipse is concerned, I could be wrong, but I don't think it's going to be visible from where we are.
Oh, of course.
Sorry about that. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
And I hopefully will have you on hopefully we'll have you on again in the spring to look forward to what is ahead in the summer.
Well,
like Mars getting pretty stinking big this year.
It's not. It's beautiful up there in the sky, but point a telescope at it and you'll be disappointed.
Okay. Well, Tom Burns, thanks as always. I hope you have a wonderful Happy New Year. Thank you so much for joining
us
today.
I'm starting my Saturnalia celebration right now. That's what New Year's really is, folks. Ask me about that next time.
Saturnalia.
It's the old Roman Saturnalia shrunk down to one frenetic evening.
Pathetic night. Okay. That is Tom Burns. He's director of the Ohio Wesleyan University's Perkins Observatory. We have him on every winter for a good reason. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to the night sky. Thanks to everybody. Thanks. Have a happy new year. We're so glad we could share a little bit of time with you before the new year. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Kyle McKinnon, Courtney Gilbert, Dan Posniak, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Have a great day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.